Ouais.
Recording in progress.
And I will allow the people in the waiting room to enter. Roberto, we're not hearing any audio. There we go.
Yes. Looking forward to that.
AGP, it looks like your audio just got muted by mistake. And the YouTube stream is running and we are recording, so we are good to go. And everything sounds good. Looks like we lost the AGP video feed. Here it comes.
Okay, I think we're ready to get going here. Good morning and happy Earth Day. Welcome to the 580th board meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, Central Valley Region. I'm Mark Bradford, the board chair of the Central Valley Water Board. I will introduce the other board members in a few minutes. We are slowly transitioning out of the COVID-19 emergency. This is a hybrid meeting where some folks will be attending in person at our Fresno office, and some will be participating via video and teleconference. Thank you in advance for your patience as we make this transition. For people who want to listen or watch the meeting online, the board's customary webcast is available. In addition, we are receiving presentations and public comment through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to present or comment or think you might be interested in commenting, you should already be in the Zoom meeting room using the meeting ID provided on the board's website and the password you receive from our staff. If you've not already received a password, you can email us now at agenda5@waterboards.ca.gov. That email address is agenda followed by the number 5 with no space at waterboards.ca.gov. Include speaker comment in the subject line so that we can follow up with you. For those in the Zoom meeting, you will be on mute and your camera turned off until it is your turn to speak. Our meeting host will then unmute you and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute and your camera turned off. We appreciate your patience and understanding during this extraordinary time. I will now introduce other board members as follows. We've got Denise Cadera from Allensworth. We've got, let's see, we don't have Raji or Carmen here. Sean Yang from Sacramento. Nick Ovdis, also from Sacramento. And Alina Lee Reeder of Sacramento. And again, I'm Mark Bradford, also from Sacramento. I will now have our executive officer, Patrick Palupa, introduce his staff.
Good morning, Chair, members of the board. happy Friday. We have a short schedule planned for us today. My name is Patrick Palupa, Executive Officer of Central Valley Water Board. To my immediate right is Jessica Yar, Senior Staff Counsel with the Office of Chief Counsel. To her right is Chris Moskal, another one of our attorneys from the Office of Chief Counsel. And to his right is Adam Lapitz, Assistant Executive Officer in our Rancho Cordova office. Sitting in the audience is JJ Baum and Clint Snyder, two other assistant executive officers from the board and various staff, including Meredith Howard, head of our planning program, whose staff will be speaking here today. With that, I'll turn it back to you, Mark.
Thank you. We are going to, oh, there's Carmen.
Good morning, I apologize.
We'll introduce Carmen Ramirez from Atwater. And then we're going to have the Pledge of Allegiance, and Denise is going to lead us.
To the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, this is a continuation of our meeting from yesterday, so we're up to agenda item 15.
Thank you, microphone.
Oops, microphone's off. This is agenda item 15, board member communications. Are there any communications since yesterday? No. Well, I had a nice dinner and had an opportunity to see Carl off one more time. And then public forum. Mindy, has anyone submitted a request to speak on any topic which is not on the agenda today?
No, Chair Bradford, no speakers.
Okay, thank you, Mindy. So the main topic of the day is agenda item 17. We're going to have an update on the Central Valley harmful algal bloom efforts. This is an informational item. It's an informational item only, and no action will be taken, although the board may ask questions and provide direction to staff. After the staff presentation, interested persons will be allowed 3 minutes each to address the board. We will now hear the staff presentation.
Good morning, Chair Bradford, and hello, everyone. Thank you.
First time here. So good morning, Chair Bradford and fellow board members. My name is Dr. Karen Atkins, and I'm an environmental scientist and the freshwater estuarine harmful algae bloom technical lead for the Central Valley Water Board. My portion of the presentation will be followed by Dr. Janice Cook, an environmental scientist specialist working on the Delta program. Today, we'll be giving you an update on our Central Valley harmful algal bloom efforts. Next slide. Okay, cool. In this presentation, I will begin with a brief scientific overview of harmful algal blooms, or HABs, including what they are, how they form, and why we care about them. The presentation will then outline the many programs that the Central Valley Water Board has addressing HABs. First, I will give an update about the freshwater and estuarine harmful algae bloom program focused on recent HAB incident response and our partner monitoring program. Then Dr. Janice Cook will describe how our efforts extend beyond this program, integrating HABs into multiple programs. She will highlight location-based studies, including studies in the Delta, Clear Lake, and Hensley and Eastman Lakes. Next slide. So let's just jump in and learn what cyanobacteria are. Cyanobacteria are microscopic bacteria that photosynthesize just like plants, and they account for about 20% of the oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere. They're about 3 to 3.5 million years old, and they're an important component in marine and freshwater aquatic ecosystems. Cyanobacteria are not all harmful, but some can produce toxins. These toxins are collectively known as cyanotoxins, which we'll discuss a little bit more later. Cyanobacteria were once thought to be a type of algae, but we now know that they're quite different. However, the naming convention is still around. So cyanobacteria will sometimes go by their legacy names, blue-green algae, or just simply harmful algae. Further, algae is often used as a general term that includes many things like cyanobacteria, green algae, diatoms, and is used in phrases such as harmful algae bloom. Next slide. The harmful algae blooms or HABs that we will discuss today are when there is a high density of cyanobacteria at a given time and location. HABs can be a natural part of a well-functioning ecosystem, but in many cases, HABs are a result of humans altering environmental conditions. They're different than some other issues we deal with because they're made out of living pollutants, unlike, say, mercury. Next slide. So there's two main types of HABs. There are planktonic HABs, which are floating and are in the picture on the left there. And they can float in the water column or near the water surface and can form these really dense scums and mats and discolor the water, making it kind of look like there was spilled paint on the top. And benthic HABs, which are in the picture on the right, are attached to submerged surfaces below the water, such as stuck to a rock or sticks. And they can form mats or spires that can detach. And then the detached chunks can be carried downstream for many miles or get beached on the shoreline. These pose a really high risk to children and pets who may ingest the washed up material. Both HAB types can occur in many types of water bodies, including lakes, reservoirs, rivers, and streams. Next slide.
Dr. Atkins?
Yeah.
Quick question on the previous slide.
Oh, can we go back? Thanks.
Anytime that we see like mats like this, like the one on the left side, because I've seen that.
Yeah.
Are they always HABs or no. Are there other kinds of algae that's not?
Yeah, great question. So sometimes if you see like green stringy ones, those are usually maybe green algae. And then there's also diatoms that are can look kind of brownish. And those are not HABs, but HABs have a specific benthic look to them that are can be identified, but need some training to do so.
Thanks.
Yeah, good question. Okay, next slide. Okay, so what are the factors that are affecting these blooms? There are many factors, physical, chemical, biological, that promote these blooms. And these factors can include nutrient over-enrichment of nitrogen and phosphorus from agricultural, industrial, urban, and residential sources, high levels of light and solar radiation that are needed for photosynthesis within the dense blooms. Low flows paired with persistent stratification create the stable water column conditions that are ideal for planktonic blooms. And then high internal recycling of nutrients within the water body increases cyanobacteria access to nutrients. And finally, increased water temperatures, say from climate change, favor cyanobacteria because their growth rates peak at high water temperatures. Climate change, though, will affect HABs beyond just a shift in temperature because changing precipitation patterns, such as stronger storms followed by drought periods, can increase HAB conditions as well. Because there are so many factors contributing to the HAB blooms, HAB management can be very challenging. Knowledge of the location and time-specific drivers are vital to implementing successful mitigation, so there's no one-size-fits-all approach for mitigating blooms at each water body, since each water body has different factors affecting the blooms. Next slide. So as I said, some cyanobacteria within the blooms form toxins called cyanotoxins. And those have many different types of cyanotoxins, but each either affect the nervous system, the liver, or the kidneys. And we can be exposed to these toxins in three main ways, through either your skin, such as if you're swimming in a HAB, inhaling aerosolized cyanotoxin particles, such as if you're boating really quickly over a HAB, or through ingesting cyanotoxins, such as if your water has cyanotoxins in it, or if dogs intentionally go and eat mats. Toxins produced high in the watershed can be carried long distances downstream. Next slide. So as a quick reminder about beneficial uses here, the Central Valley Water Board's basin plans for the Sacramento and San Joaquin River basins and the Tulare Lake Basin contains beneficial use definitions and designations for surface and groundwaters within the region. Water bodies may have multiple beneficial uses to be protected, and the state law defines beneficial uses that may be protected against water quality degradation to include, but not be limited to, domestic, municipal, agricultural, and industrial supply, power generation, recreation, aesthetic enjoyment, navigation, and preservation and enhancement of fish, wildlife, other aquatic resources, and preserves. The State Water Board has also established beneficial use definitions pertaining to the tribal, traditional, and cultural, and subsistence fishing uses. Protection and enhancement of existing and potential beneficial uses are primary goals of the board's water quality planning. Next slide. So why do we care about HABs? We all enjoy swimming and fishing, kayaking, maybe hiking with our furry friends, and industries, including agriculture, rely on clean water. HABs affect 12 beneficial uses, which are the Central Valley Water Board's responsibility to protect. That's more beneficial uses than many other contaminants. And these include tribal and cultural uses, ecosystem function, aesthetics, taste and odor compounds, and cyanobacteria that are producing cyanotoxins can lead to potential health issues with drinking water, fishing, agriculture, and recreation. Unlike some other pollutants, HABs are not benign and can cause serious illness and in some cases death. They can accumulate in tissues and sediment, although unlike mercury, they don't persist through bioaccumulation. HABs can be found in almost every part of our region, and in some, they're beginning to persist year-round, so this isn't an isolated issue. Next slide. Further, HAB impacts compound adverse conditions common in economically disadvantaged communities. For example, by limiting HAB access to recreational opportunities, such as in Stockton, where HABs are very widespread, or by limiting access to clean water, such as in Clear Lake area's Do Not Drink order, which was caused by cyanotoxins last summer. By worsening limited access to health care, HABs can create or worsen adverse health effects as a result of cyanotoxins, exacerbating the effects of limited access to health care. And by causing economic impacts, such as when HABs reduce tourism income in locally struggling economies. Janice will cover some more about these topics, Clear Lake and Stockton area, in the second part of the presentation. So these impacts will accelerate with climate change. As was recognized in the 2021 Board Strategic Plan, the climate crisis is resulting in uneven impacts. HABs are worsened by climate change impacts, so HABs will disproportionately affect economically disadvantaged areas, which may have less resources for adaptation in response to climate change. Next slide. So there's many Central Valley Water Board programs involved in HAB work, and these include the Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program, or SWAMP, Basin Planning, the Delta Program, the Nonpoint Source Program, the Total Maximum Daily Load Program, or TMDLs, and finally, the Freshwater and Estuarine Harmful Algae Bloom Program, FHAB, has been charged with HAB incident response, monitoring, research, and outreach. So I'm going to focus on the FHAB portion of this, and then Janice will talk a little bit more about some of these other parts. Next slide. The FHAB program was started in 2016 through the Office of Information Management and Analysis, OIMA, and SWAMP. However, the program was unfunded and therefore needed to borrow from other programs until Assembly Bill 834 passed in 2019. The bill objectives, which I'll discuss in more detail in a moment, include coordinating immediate and long-term event response and communicating risks, coordinating monitoring and assessment to track status and trends and help identify at-risk water bodies, conducting applied research and tool development, providing outreach, education, a centralized website, and data management. This program focuses on the recreational component of HABS rather than the drinking water risks and management. So let's discuss this first point, the event response. Next slide. So HAB incidents are reported to us in three main ways. One is through our online Bloom Report system. Typically, it's from a concerned citizen or a stakeholder organization through an online Bloom Report form. The next is through illness or death reports. Many of these can come from county health departments, the California Poison Control Center, or online Bloom Reports. And the third is the San Francisco Estuary Institute and SWAMPS satellite imagery tool. This is a screening tool that shows where blooms are developing. It reports an estimated amount of cyanobacteria, but it cannot show the amount of toxins. It displays imagery for only the largest water bodies, so it only covers a very small portion of our region's water bodies. Next slide. So here's just a quick screenshot of what our online Bloom Report looks like. It asks for information about the reporting party, the water body, the algal bloom itself, and other relevant information, and you can access it from the link below. Next slide. So what you're looking at now is a map of bloom reports from 2021. Each dot is an individual bloom report that we received. These are from the public or agencies who happen to be in the area, not from our repeated monitoring sites. The blue dots are where we had visual indications of a bloom. Often someone sent us a picture. The pink dots are where some form of cyanotoxin testing indicated that there was toxins. And the greens are where they had both visual and cyanotoxin testing. So as you can see, starting from the north, we have bloom report hotspots in areas like Lake Almanor, Clear Lake, the North Fork of the American River, the Delta, such as near Stockton and near Discovery Bay, and near Fresno, such as in Pensley and Eastman Lakes. Next slide. So let's talk about what occurs when we get an incident report. The process starts on the top with an initial report that's sent to us through the state reporting system and interagency task force. This is then displayed on a public-facing web map so that the public can stay up to date with what HABs are occurring. The FHAB team then leads coordination of the response and communication with the local entities, such as water and recreation managers, agency staff, and local coordinators. When a potential HAB may impact both recreational and source water, the State Board's Division of Drinking Water leads response with the water purveyors. If a suspected human or animal illness is connected to the report, then the Interagency Illness Work Group, which includes the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, or OEHA, Public Health, and Fish and Wildlife, provides additional follow-up investigation. In these cases, the Central Valley Water Board Management is also notified. Next slide. Next slide. Thank you. The FHAB Central Valley Water Board staff fills many, but not all of the roles in this process. So the Central Valley Water Board coordinates response, such as implementing the state voluntary guidance for recreational waters, notifying appropriate parties via email or phone of an event, including the Central Valley Water Board Management, providing monitoring support and training, recommending recreational postings, updating the FHAB database and web map, and conducting public outreach. Local partners conduct response as well, and these include things such as collecting samples and posting signs. And finally, the illness work group leads and manages illness cases, although the Central Valley Water Board staff supports the environmental component of this work, or the monitoring component, sorry. Next slide. So there's many challenges to our FHAB incident response efforts. Some of these challenges can be seen by looking at the historic report numbers. Formal incident response tracking began in 2016. All of the incidents in this table at the top were from public or the public or agencies who happened to be in these areas, not from routine monitoring sites. And since the start of our monitoring, we have had many reports, as you can see, especially last year. The illness team began tracking illnesses 2 years later, so in 2018, and the reports are made initially by Poison Control Center, the public, or some health departments. Then they're investigated by the illness work group and may not necessarily have been found to be HAB related. The statewide graph that you can see on this slide shows the cases that had sufficient information to determine that they were related to HABs. The colors represent years and the bars are clustered by affected group. These are then submitted to a federal CDC database. Approximately double the number of incidents, as are on this chart, were initially reported and took staff time to investigate. Those not included in this graph either had insufficient information for determination or were determined to be not HAB related. No human death reports to our system have ever been considered to be HAB related. But increasingly, statewide illnesses and death cases have been submitted to the CDC since 2018. Only in late 2020 did the Poison Control Center start sharing these HAB exposures with our illness team. So this does not necessarily mean that more folks are being exposed. It just means that we're hearing about more of those exposures. Currently, most of the state's FHAB funding, greater than 65% of it, goes to incident response. But sampling is really costly and time consuming to perform. And interagency coordination, while very important, is time consuming as well. So we've had to prioritize certain aspects of this work to keep up with it. Next slide. So first, we prioritize incident response by the type of report we receive. Illness or death reports are top priority. Online bloom reports are medium priority and typically we'll ask a local agency to help with the sampling there. And then the sampling imagery tool or the satellite imagery tool is low priority and is used as time allows. Sometimes we attempt to contact responsible parties, but we do not every time. This is low priority in part because it's not always accurate and can only speak to cyanobacteria as opposed to cyanotoxin amounts. So it needs to be field verified before we can really use it. Next slide. Due to the large report volume, we also are prioritizing cases based on the level of risk they pose to public health. We prioritize sampling water bodies with publicly accessible rivers and lakes and high recreational use and drinking water. But resources are limited for private water bodies, and we refer some of those cases to county public health departments. In the coming years, due to changes in funding sources over time, our response budget will decline, leading to less incident response sampling and more cases with an underestimation of health risk. To minimize the impacts of limited incident response, we're becoming more proactive to establish a routine monitoring program. Next slide. So now we're going to shift and we're going to discuss this monitoring and assessment aspect, conducting monitoring and assessment to track status and trends and help identify at-risk water bodies. Next slide. So here again, we're looking back at what water bodies had blooms in 2021. And as you can see, public reports are concentrated in economically disadvantaged communities and communities of color, showing that HABs are an environmental justice issue in our region. We're moving towards a proactive monitoring approach in these high report areas. Prioritizing routine monitoring on HAB status and trends increases the understanding of the extent and magnitude of HABs in the state, as well as the socioeconomic and social impacts of HABs on disadvantaged communities. Increased prioritization of HAB monitoring and assessment will increase our general understanding of HABs in the region, and an understanding of this issue is one component needed to implement management actions and mitigate impacts. Next slide. So partner monitoring is a growing aspect of the FHAB program. This monitoring will support HAB incident response by creating pre-existing data and warning the public of problem areas. The partner monitoring program is outlined in the HAB monitoring framework and strategic report that specifically outlines the priorities for implementing Assembly Bill 834. The goals of the partner monitoring are to improve human health protection, help identify and prioritize at-risk water bodies for management, and provide consistent monitoring of reoccurring HAB sites. The Central Valley Water Board offers services to our partners. We assist in developing monitoring plans. We provide training in monitoring methods. We provide financial support and/or supplies for their monitoring. And we can provide outreach platforms for their results. And results of these programs are also treated as incident response. The results are publicly available on our HAB web map, and local entities are notified and encouraged to post appropriate signage. Next slide. So the partners are vital to the success of a region-wide partner monitoring program. Most obviously, partners are needed to expand the capacity of our program. Often they live near the sites they're monitoring, and our community partners can conduct more frequent monitoring and often have a detailed knowledge of the area that they're monitoring. They also sometimes have access to restricted locations on private property. Our partners are highly trained in many methods, and we offer training in a range of methods. We have partners monitoring using both visual identification with the naked eye, microscopic identification of cyanobacteria, in-the-field chemistry tests, and they're collecting water samples for in-depth lab analysis. Our partners are also our community ambassadors to HABs. They're local experts in the issue that can serve to inform and protect locals in the most HAB-affected regions. Next slide. In 2021, we had quite a bit of monitoring centered around a few impacted water bodies in the region. We had 6 partner monitoring organizations communicating their monitoring data to us, including the Department of Water Resources, Big Valley Rancheria, Elm Indian Colony, Nautilus Data Technologies, Kern County Public Health Department, and data from our own projects at the Central Valley Water Board. Next slide. So this year, we have been able to partner with some additional organizations to fill some really important data gaps, and that will be filling the red circles on the map with information there. Restore the Delta, Little Manila Rising, San Francisco Baykeeper, and the California Striped Bass Association are collaborating on a project to collect cyanotoxin data near 7 sites in the Stockton area, and will be monitoring starting in the coming weeks. The California State Parks will be monitoring 4 sites on the North Fork American River for both planktonic and benthic blooms. And both of these locations are high exposure areas due to being popular recreation sites. The FHAB team is also developing new partner monitoring resources to quickly onboard new partners in the future. These include a new website with training resources, new training videos, new templates to help community scientists write unique sampling plans, and much more. We're also reaching out to our communities that have frequent HABs and we haven't heard from yet so that we can recruit new partners. So that will conclude my portion of the presentation, and I'll take any questions and then we'll move on to Janice's part.
So late last year, so I'm from Merced, just up the way.
Oh yeah.
And last year there was a, you know, highly publicized death of a small family up in Mariposa. Yeah. It was a husband, a wife, and a baby. And even though later it was determined that harmful algae blooms, HABs were not part of, you know, the cause of death, it really kind of made a big splash. And I see the areas that are highlighted, and I see that there's no real partners up in the foothills. So is that something that the board is working on? Or because I'm close to that area, so I'd be happy to, you know, assist if I could, but I'm just wondering what's happened.
Yeah, that's a great question. So we definitely don't have enough partners yet, and we're definitely trying to expand that. This is a somewhat new foray that we're going into for HABS. And so that's definitely something we want to build capacity towards. And we are reaching out to people as we are able to build capacity to take on new people. But yeah, definitely we have a lack of data in that area that needs to be filled. Yeah. And I think especially with the benthic algae blooms, like they had in that area too, that's something that we're quite behind on and are learning more about every couple.
Yeah. Even though that was a tragic event and harmful, HABS didn't have anything to do with it, it did sort of raise awareness to people in that area. That, you know, they wouldn't think about before. Up in the foothills, people just assume that water's, you know, healthy to drink and all these other things. So at least it raised awareness.
Yeah.
But I do see that there's a gap of information going up that way.
Yeah, you're definitely right.
Yes. I remember back in 2016 when this issue became an issue, and the numbers are increasing. And so I'm presuming it's climate change is a contributing factor, but I want to know if has there been anything to identify what has contributed to the HABS in the disadvantaged communities? What are the contributing factors there?
Yeah, so it's, of course, very community dependent, and it's very water to body dependent, as I mentioned. But I guess a couple different things probably all come together. So there's maybe more nutrient pollution going on in that area. Or maybe there's like in the Stockton area, there's also a lot of kind of stagnant waterways with dead ends in that area. And then climate change, like you said, is also really important. But it's definitely water body dependent. So it's hard to say a blanket answer.
Yeah, no, thank you for that comment. And I think it's one of the reasons why you know, we have such partnerships in Stockton. It's and I want to thank Dr. Atkins. She's a relatively new addition to our team. I mean, I was commenting to Jessica. I'm not sure if we've ever had the pleasure of hearing from, frankly, three PhDs that all have expertise in this area. In Dr. Howard, Dr. Cook, and Dr. Atkins, we're very grateful for their expertise that they've brought to the board on these issues. But it's complicated. I mean, there's a reason why you know, this merits so much study and so much inquiry, because it is at the nexus of so many water quality and water rights issues, because it's a combination of the geometry of the water system. It's a combination of heat and flow. And certainly what we have some control over are the nutrients. And there are major efforts underway. I think Dr. Cook touches on it in her presentation as well, for biostimulatory and biointegrity, which are probably more accurate than harmful algal blooms, as Dr. Atkin pointed out, efforts to really understand what are the drivers. And we actually have, you know, the Clear Lake, one of the things that we're doing with Clear Lake is we looked very closely at it, adopted a TMDL. A lot of research went into it, a lot of thought went into it. And it turns out we weren't really correct what the main driver was. It wasn't so much phosphorus as it was other issues, or not necessarily on-stream phosphorus, but other issues. And so it's an incredibly complex problem, but it does rear its ugly head in a lot of disadvantaged communities and areas where we have sensitivity to water supply issues. So it's absolutely something that merits additional study, and that's why we've got the team working on it the way we do.
I'm just realizing, I mean, like I said, back in 2016, when the issue came up, I recall one staff member, I can't recall her name, but she did the presentation on it.
Christine.
Yeah. Yeah. And the numbers, it's just grown. It's not anything that's there where numbers are shrinking. It's continuing.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. And I think also some of that is we're receiving more reports as well. So, okay. Our website is more publicized.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's good. The work that's being done since that time has been great. And you've done an excellent presentation. So we'll look forward to hearing the other parts of the presentation. Thank you.
Hey, Dr. Atkin, before you go, thank you again. Very, very informative. If I'm seeing this correctly in terms of process, it seems like obviously a lot of data collection at this point, and then obviously localized to the specific water bodies where we're having these issues. You know, in terms of the long-term trajectory here, is it to prioritize the most at-risk water bodies and the most at-risk disadvantaged communities to sort of focus our efforts? Obviously, we are a limited number of people, obviously, and at some point we do have to prioritize. So
that's right.
So what is the long-term trajectory as it relates to
apps? So I think the main kind of idea here is that we're going to start collecting more data, and we need to have a better understanding of which water bodies to prioritize. And then we can start moving towards some of those more implementation.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. And I think that, you know, part of the challenge, and thankfully the legislature has recognized this, given us a little bit of resources for it. You know, as you know, we're an agency that's funded by dischargers. You know, they pay their permit fees, we do our work. This is kind of out of the box a little bit, right? This is kind of within the planning program. You know, I don't want to say this is an area that's been nickel and dimed in the past, but we it's not as easily fundable as it is, you know, asking an NPDES discharger to fund a monitoring program. What's coming out of your pipe? This is more of an assessment of water quality. There's a number of factors driving these water quality issues. It's diffuse. And so it's a challenge to find the resources to do this type of work. We've got a limited set of resources. And, you know, I think the challenge in the years to come will be, you know, we hear often, even the presentation yesterday, you know, the nitrate standard is 10 milligrams per liter, right? That's what we hear over and over again for drinking water. But it may be the case that nitrate levels much, much, much lower than that are potential drivers for harmful algal blooms, or one of the many drivers for harmful algal blooms. So that has ramifications for our programs in a bunch of different areas, you know, more stringent regulation of agricultural discharges, more stringent regulation potentially of other, you know, NPDES dischargers to make sure that their facilities aren't driving harmful algal blooms. And then, you know, you also have to factor in the other factors that lead to harmful algal blooms. So it's a really, really vexing issue for our board, not just in terms of resources, but what the regulatory approach needs to be.
I'll just add one more thing to that too. And Janice is going to touch on this a little bit in her segment of the talk, but we are doing a eutrophication assessment in the region. And one of the goals of that is to really use different both existing data and satellite imagery to really identify like what are our, you know, kind of what are the general conditions, and then which water bodies are kind of in the worst shape that we should prioritize. Like that's really the goal of that, is to help narrow the scope of like, where do we really need to put our very limited resources? So I think that's kind of our, I'll call it a shorter term, maybe 3-year goal that will probably drive our longer term. How do we address this or start to address it in the region?
All right. Thank you. And thank you for all your work. Thank you.
Dr. Atkins, I have one more question. It seems like there must be some publication or outreach effort going on to let people know what the symptoms of being exposed to HABs are. Is that true? Or I see you mentioned that the reporting of incidents is increasing, but I suspect that there might be a lot more reporting if people realize that they may have been exposed and it wasn't just a bad tuna sandwich or something.
I suppose. I mean, we have our website and we have materials that are at many of the like state parks. If you go, you'll see that they have signs posted that say a little bit about that and have linked to much more information. We also do a little bit of PR every year to let people know when HAB season is coming, what to look out for. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah. Well, what are the symptoms? If somebody was exposed or a dog is exposed and people don't realize that it might have been from the exposure to HABs.
It depends on what type of cyanobacteria occur. Okay. A lot of the human symptoms are either like a skin rash or that kind of thing if they had dermal contact, or it can be kind of a long-term chronic thing. So that's kind of the main concern, I think, for humans, is that we're having rather low amounts and then we might have, you know, like tumors after a long period of time. Mm-hmm. So that, and then for dogs, we can have very immediate responses where they'll have like a seizure type of thing or that kind of thing, and then they'll pass away, unfortunately. So because dogs, you know, you don't really know those early symptoms, often it's pretty dramatic.
Right.
Does anyone have any?
Thank you.
And if you could speak to the process that's used to identify the coordination that we have with State Board and other agencies, if Janice isn't going to talk about that.
Okay. So I guess the process is that it goes, so this is not part of we don't deal with the public health aspect so much. It gets sent to an interagency work group, and they have public health people, that's their expertise, that is not my expertise. And so they will collect data, investigate individual cases, and then they will determine whether or not it warrants being sent to this CDC database. So they don't actually conclude whether or not something is definitively HAB related, but they narrow it down a little bit more and then decide if to send it off to the CDC.
I have a question. Thank you for the presentation. I just want to know more in depth in terms of, manpower and funding. So currently, how many people are working in this assessment project?
Yeah, so I guess, like I said, there's many different programs that are working on HABs at the state boards. The FHAB program specifically, which is the one that I have just presented to you about, we have 5 people statewide, and I am the only person for our board.
Okay, and thank you for your work. Yeah. Follow up on that. Are we allocate any future fund to support this program? Because it seems to be a very important program, and there's a lot other that are important, but I'm just curious to know.
That would be part of the legislative process.
Okay, so at this point, we are not sure.
Yeah, I think there is some recognition that the need is there, that additional resources will be required. You know, I think one of the challenges whenever we're talking about a program like this, and I've brought this up to you before, if we're putting this on existing staff, what's going to come off? You know, is this a priority over something else? But yeah, this is an area that merits additional resources. But really, the question, it's an interagency one, right? You know, CDPH has a role, Fish and Wildlife has a role, State Board has a role, counties and local governments have a role, and certainly the water managers as well, you know, have a role in this. So it's complicated. You know, one of the areas that some of the areas where you see the cluster are DWR managed reservoirs, you know, so it's a very broad discussion. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, and I'll just add that within our funding, within the Central Valley Regional Board, we get some discretionary funds. We have some swamp funds. We have put quite a bit of that towards, you know, the analysis of samples. So when Karen's talking about building out her partner monitoring efforts, we're paying for the analysis through some of our regional board funding. So we're doing what we can with what we've got. You know, but yeah.
and a lot of that will be in the executive officer report. So essentially of our overall budget and swamp for those of you who might not be familiar with it, isn't actually swamps. It's a surface water ambient monitoring program that is a statewide initiative to better integrate some of the water quality data. There's a limited amount of resources there to do some monitoring and sampling, part of our recreational use assessment, where we go out and sample, you know, areas that are highly, you know, used by communities, you know, swimming holes and things like that, is done under our swamp program funds. We are also doing this with a little bit of swamp program funds. We also have a small amount of discretionary funds. That's basically, you know, the state board says, what are your most important water quality issues? We, in the past, we've funded things like CEQA stuff from that. We funded tribal beneficial use coordination, sometimes successfully, sometimes not so successfully. This is one of the areas where we've invested that. And I don't want to say it's couch change, but you know, it's a little bit of money that we have and to allocate towards kind of lab resources to do this type of sampling and work. I think ultimately, you know, especially if the biointegrity program steps up and is recognized by the legislature as a priority for water quality, we will see more funds going into this area, more allocations among existing funds going into that area. I don't know if that answers everything, but
yeah. Well, thank you for detailing it, and kudos to you and for partnering with other agencies and folks. So continue the partnership. I think that's great. Thank you.
And Christine left our agency, but she's still working on it. And I think she's with Fish and Wildlife. It's an issue that was, you know, certainly you are near and dear to her heart, and it came through in the presentation. So she left her position where she's still doing more of that over at Fish and Wildlife right now. She gave the presentation in 2016 that Denise Cadaro was mentioning.
All right.
Yeah. Do you anticipate working on a follow-up bill? I noticed that Assemblymember Bloom carry this, and there is $875,000 for 5 positions. How is that allocated? Do we need to work harder for more funding? I mean, I can only see this problem getting worse. I mean, what do you need?
So really, really quickly, legislative requests have to go through the governor's office and are confidential. So we don't discuss that in public. I'm certainly glad that you recognize that, but that's a matter that we can't discuss in public.
Karen, I don't know if we have any information yet, but I know that the State Water Board just did a gap assessment for all the regions to find out if there was funding needs. Yeah. When's that supposed to, do you know when that's supposed to roll that out or be able to go for more funding in that gap assessment?
I do not know the date of when that's
okay.
I don't know the date of when that's going to come out.
That is... underway anyways. Yeah, they're trying to get some funding, and we put in a pretty big ask, I believe, in that. I remember reviewing what staff put together, so I was impressed by it, and hopefully we will see something come from that.
All right, thanks so much.
So good morning, Chairman Bradford and members of the board. I'm Janice Cook. I'm a senior environmental scientist specialist in the planning section in the Sacramento office. So could maybe go to the part 2 slide. Oh, next one. Next presentation. There's another PowerPoint. Okay, so while he's pulling that up. So Karen introduced you to harmful algal blooms and their impacts on beneficial uses, and really focused on the freshwater harmful algal bloom program. I'm going to illustrate how these intersect with some of the other work that we're doing. You asked, what are we doing with this information and what will the outcomes be? So I hope to touch on some of those answers some more. Okay, so I'm starting with the bullet that says HAB intersections with multiple board programs. And then I will give you some examples. And I want to point out that with the example projects, I'm going to be presenting work that's on behalf of other folks in our Sacramento and our Fresno offices. So you'll be seeing a combination of efforts from some very capable colleagues. Next slide, please. Okay, so first, another definition. The word already came up in Meredith's remarks. So HABs are a eutrophication issue. So eutrophication can be defined as just excess algal or plant growth in an aquatic environment in a over geologic time. In some areas, eutrophication is a natural process. But the eutrophication that we're concerned about is largely human caused, and it happens in years to decades. Karen mentioned these drivers that you see on the slide: nutrients, adequate light, low flow, which represents a long water residence time, internal nutrients, and of course, water temperature. HABs are one of the indicators of human-caused eutrophication, and our water board addresses other water quality issues like low dissolved oxygen and excess weed growth that are also eutrophic conditions. So we're working on, in the planning section, we're working on bringing these issues together, and we use our eutrophication as just an umbrella concept where we're trying to address HABs as well as other water quality problems that are being caused by similar, nutrients and other drivers. Okay, next slide, please. And Karen also showed you this slide. Center Valley Water Board efforts to address eutrophication, we actually house them in multiple programs, and efforts proceed in all three of our offices. So Karen described the response and outreach within the FHAB program, and actually all of the monitoring we do has some connection to SWAMP, or the Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program. I was actually out on the Delta yesterday collecting samples with a SWAMP colleague driving the boat, so we couldn't do it without them. On the planning side, FHAB and eutrophication efforts overall are components and are housed in other Region 5 programs, namely basin planning, the Delta program, our non-point source, and TMDLs, or total maximum daily loads. And TMDL, if you're not familiar, that's an acronym from the Federal Clean Water Act. Total maximum daily load refers to the total reductions in a pollutant in a particular water body that would be needed to restore that water body to meeting water quality objectives. So TMDLs are used when a pollution that's enters a water body from multiple sources. So this is the kind of management action that we may ultimately need to address some of the HABs problems, because, for example, nutrients come from multiple sources. And a TMDL, we also use the term to describe the full water quality control program that comes out of doing that math. What do my reductions need to be? And this board has actually amended our basin plans with TMDLs for other water quality problems, including dissolved oxygen. And one of the examples that I'm going to share is about revising a TMDL. So, okay, next slide, please. But before moving on to the examples, I'll describe one more organizational aspects of our HABs and eutrophication work. We are addressing these through multiple programs. Another framework for thinking about Water Board's eutrophication efforts are some of our outcomes that show up as deliverables or show up in our project work plans. And four significant outcomes are monitoring, assessment, water quality objectives, and implementation actions. Monitoring includes routine monitoring through our Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program and the response through the FHAB program. Then the monitoring data are used to assess the status of water quality conditions and whether beneficial uses are being met. And so the integrated report is the most formal example of this. Water quality objectives are key components of our Central Valley Region's basin plans. New numeric water quality objectives for eutrophication problems like our cyanobacteria toxins, we don't have those water quality objectives yet. So when that happens, that would probably be on a statewide basis. Those would actually be incorporated into our basin plan. And Patrick mentioned the statewide biostimulatory project. That's state water board is working on gathering data, identifying what do thresholds need to be to protect wadable streams and lakes and reservoirs from eutrophication problems. And biostimulation is another term, sorry for the jargon, that is also used to describe eutrophic conditions. Okay. And then lastly, on the implementation actions take the form of TMDLs to address multiple sources and pollutants. And we can put bubbles around our programs and blocks around these outcomes, but actually there's a lot of interdisciplinary and between program work that goes on to address these problems. And I'm going to illustrate that with the three examples I follow. Oh, go ahead, Carmen.
Dr. Cook, when you say biostimulatory, what I remember is a few years back, we were talking about aerators. That's not it, right? Are we talking about that?
No. That was for potentially implementing, aerators are implemented as a mitigation for nutrient problems in lakes. That probably came up in front of the board for our mercury program as a potential management measure for methylmercury production in reservoirs.
It was the DO and
the station. Sorry. Of course. Yes. It is an option in some locations for addressing dissolved oxygen and circulating water to prevent algal growth. There's a photo of the one at UC Davis on my ending slide. It is potentially a management measure in a small water body.
I see. So that's statewide biostimulatory projects.
That's
not it.
No. Okay. So the statewide biostimulatory project is what was formerly called the NNE. And then it became, it was numeric nutrient endpoint. So State Water Board has had it's like a 10 plus year project working toward nitrogen and phosphorus limits, very likely numeric ones to protect wadable streams. And one of the benchmarks they are looking at were what's the health of wadable streams in terms of the organisms that live there. We expect that this time around, state boards also are going to include cyanobacteria toxins in both the streams and the lakes piece of it. So we'll probably have those linked in that statewide project.
And not to oversimplify, but I think biostimulatory is that nitrogen and phosphorus are basically like fish food for the algae that we don't want. And so the idea is try and knock that down. And how far we need to knock those numbers down is really one of the focuses of the biostimulatory project. So again, that's a horrible oversimplification, but that's how I understand it.
So, and then what's the F in FHAB?
Fresh water.
Sorry. Okay. No, she said it and I should have wrote it down, but I got it. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Next slide, please. Okay. So now I'm segueing onto the examples. First one is the Delta, where I've been doing a lot of my work. So the map on the right is the Sacramento San Joaquin River Delta. The legal delta is defined in statute is the yellow area. The brown dots, which I apologize, aren't too obvious, are locations in the delta where harmful algal blooms were reported just in 2021. Those were all at least visual, and we had cyanotoxin measurements at some of those locations. And in the delta, it's all the floating kind. Karen mentioned you have both floating and benthic in the delta. It's all the floating kind. And these reports did generate advisories, at least at the caution level. Freshwater cyanobacteria called Microcystis is the most common type in the delta. And clumps of this comprising a bloom, were first observed in the Delta by Dr. Peggy Lehman at the Department of Water Resources in 1999. I think it's not a stretch to say that since then, both bloom severity has increased, the number of locations we see it, the length of the season, which is usually about now, it's about June to October in the Delta, the number of species, and in we're also concerned about the number of different toxins increasing. There are several sites, and those are shown by those green ovals, where blooms in the Delta are particularly noxious and long-lasting in Discovery Bay and Stockton Waterfront are those locations. In the Delta, we're really trying to better understand the blooms in these areas and the possibilities for management. Okay, next slide, please. So, and one of the things we're doing is increasing our partner monitoring. Karen mentioned that the FHAB program is expanding its partner monitoring effort, and we are have some really exciting work going in 2022 with some community scientists and advocates in the Stockton area that's, I think, really going to add to what we understand about this system. So first, Restore the Delta and their colleagues will be collecting water samples at about 7 sites and using rapid tests to detect the presence of toxins. We talked about funding. I do know that Restore the Delta and their local community partners obtained their own grant funding to do this work. And they may, I'm hoping they'll have time to comment at the end of my presentation if they're here at this meeting. So Water Board staff, our partner piece of that is we'll be supporting them by sending lab samples to the lab for analysis. And we'll also be using our boat to collect sites in open water where they may not be able to reach. Water Board staff have connected with a research team from University of North Carolina. They're funded to come out here and monitor for the presence of airborne toxins. That's the first time it's been done in the Delta. So that monitoring is going to start in 2022. And also, hot off the press, I learned yesterday that the Port of Stockton and the City of Stockton are also funding some in-depth data collection to try to learn more about what's our internal cycling of nutrients in the Stockton waterfront. So, and this project actually benefits 3 Water Board efforts. We're addressing a human health concern at a known hotspot. The freshwater harmful algal bloom program has a monitoring strategy that, as Karen described, they're trying to increase their partner monitoring. And so we're filling a piece of that. And then lastly, the Central Valley Water Board strategic plan, which was actually adopted by this board in 2021 of October, contains a strategic objective for engaging with underserved and underrepresented communities. So next slide, please. Okay, but there are really questions about what do we do about, and what are the drivers in particular water bodies? So staff is part of a team investigating another potential driver for harmful algal blooms in the Stockton area. That's whether or not cells are settling to the bottom and overwintering in the sediment so that once you've got a bloom in one season, you're primed and ready to go for the bloom in the next season. So we've been collecting sediment cores and with partners at Robertson Bryan and Bend Genetics, looking at how viable are the cells that overwinter, and are they the same kinds of strains of cyanobacteria that we see in the blooms the next season? So that study is actually wrapping up this spring. So, okay, next slide. All right. Second example and area of a lot of effort is Clear Lake. So Clear Lake is our largest natural freshwater lake entirely in the boundaries of California. It also experiences annual harmful algal blooms. And this slide lists 4 of our initiatives in the Clear Lake area. First of all, Clear Lake is listed on the Clean Water Act Section 303D list of impaired water bodies since 1986 as impaired for nutrients. And we just got this new cycle, the 2020-2022 cycle, just resulted in a new listing for microcystins, cyanobacteria toxin. Some of the effort going there, we do expect to lead to regulatory outcomes to address those formally identified impairments. that would be under our Clear Lake Nutrients Control Program. Also going on in Clear Lake, the state legislature established a Blue Ribbon Committee for the Rehabilitation of Clear Lake. And my colleague, Jen LeBay, she heads the Nonpoint Source Program. She is our Water Board's representative on that committee. The committee includes representatives from the tribes, Lake County, UC Davis, and the Water Board. And their purpose is to make recommendations. They also have funding to distribute for addressing water quality issues in Clear Lake, including harmful algal blooms. But they have a lot of issues they're working on. And lastly, I want to emphasize that the tribes in the Clear Lake area really lead the monitoring efforts for HABs. They also have their own funding. So board staff participates in the cyanobacteria task force that the tribes lead. It was their data that was used to trigger that microcystin listing for our water body impairment. So, and their data also goes into public advisory postings.
You know, yeah. I remember, I mean, I know this is our first in-person meeting, so I'm jumping way ahead, but that Clear Lake visit that we had really cemented the complexities and how vital it is, right? I mean, I see this, I'm like, yeah, that's really bad that they can't go swimming or people get sick or, you know, there's subsistence fishing is a problem, but it's one thing to see it like this. And it's another thing to see it and hear from the people. I mean, I remember when we had that event in the park and people from the community came out and it really felt like an important thing to do. And I know that, like I said, I know we're just starting out again in person, but that's a really valuable thing. I remember we did that for Iron Mountain. We've done things like that really cement our role in pushing and advocating for things like this. So, you know, just put it out there.
We'll keep doing it for what it's worth. I even for the June board meeting, there's going to be a tour component where we'll get out and we'll hear a little bit about, you know, mining issues in the foothill area. So we plan on doing that as much as we can, you know, to get you out. And if it's it may not be the full board, it may be work groups getting out there to talk to communities and see water quality issues firsthand.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. But the real part is we're talking about an economy that's not thriving as it once was because of this. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the tribal rituals and all of those things that are not happening because of this. I mean, to look at it, it's really a serious issue. So yeah, those tours are valuable.
Yeah. Okay. So next slide, please. So Patrick mentioned that the Water Board had adopted a TMDL. We also call it our Clear Lake Nutrients Control Program to address that nutrient listing from 1986. This board adopted that TMDL in 2006. It was focused on phosphorus reductions, reducing phosphorus from both point and non-point sources. And that TMDL actually only looked at external sources. So what was coming new into the lake? Some dischargers have have met their load allocations and are in compliance with that TMDL. Others are still working on achieving that compliance. We actually anticipate revising that TMDL. That's again, work under Meredith and under Jen LeBay, because new data shows that probably about 60% of the phosphorus in the lake is actually internal cycling. So we need to address that. And also in order to address the problem, it isn't just enough of shutting off the new phosphorus inputs. And we've also learned that the nitrogen affects what cyanobacteria species we see at different times in the lake. So addressing nitrogen as well, which was not a part of the original TMDL. So we do anticipate revising that one. And next slide, please. Staff has put, money through our discretionary contract process and staff time into what we call the HAB Environmental Drivers Study. It's a really an in-depth study to inform that TMDL. There were a variety of methods and really some cool new technology used to track nutrients out in the open water, identify what kind of cyanobacteria species we have. Actually, it matters because we have cyanotoxins and we have cyanobacteria species, and some species produce more than one toxin. Some species, you get one toxin can be produced by more than one species. So actually, who's producing the toxin and what do you need in order to control that organism? That matters as well. So the HAB environmental driver study is ongoing, and then we'll use that information to revise the TMDL. Okay. And all right, next slide, please. And then the third project that we wanted to highlight was the Hensley and Eastman Lakes HAB study. And this actually is being designed and conducted by Cameron Alfing right in the Fresno office. He's investigating HABs at two lakes north of here. They're mostly in Madera County, about an hour north. And they're popular locations for fishing and other recreational pursuits. HAB blooms have been observed there yearly since 2018. And the maps here indicate are the sampling locations. There's two on each lake. And then he's gathering data from the main input flowing into the lake. And because these are reservoirs, the surface level changes. So the ovals show that when the water level's down, Cameron has to walk a lot farther in the heat to get his samples because, okay, so next slide, please. Oh, and I should say that study started in 2020 and he's continuing throughout this next year. Okay, so the goals of the study are to address two questions. Really, Karen mentioned we lack routine monitoring. So this study is implementing that, looking at what are the water quality conditions in the lakes before and after the blooms, as well as during the blooms. So he's going all year round. And we've got these two lakes that do show different HAB profiles. So why do the HABs differ despite their similarities in environment and recreational use? Karen mentioned the satellite tool that's available. Actually, it's available to the public on go through the FHAB portal, and then there's a link shown on the slide right there. The satellite data from it's imagery collected from a European Space Agency satellite, and then it's interpreted by NOAA, the federal government, and you get this interpretive scale of how much algal bloom do you see at each of these water bodies. The black means it was absent. Red or pink means it's really high. These are just example shots of what the satellite imagery showed last year. And there are definitely differences in the profiles between these lakes. And unlike in the Delta, these were showing HAB blooms in December and January and February.
Can I ask a question on this?
Yeah.
It seems like you would expect the blooms to be more prominent during June and August, but this doesn't reflect that.
Why is that? Right. And Cameron could probably tell you more because he has the data on temperature, but water clarity. If you've had a big flushing event like we did in October, brings in fresh nutrients. I did notice the annual pattern was different because I was looking back through different satellite pattern, but we are seeing HAB blooms in some of the water reservoirs. It's not just, say, Eastman and Hensley in the winter. Meredith, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that's pretty much it. But I will say one of the things we noticed just even statewide is, you know, everyone goes out during the peak bloom season and collects samples, and there's very few programs that sample all year. And what's interesting is there are some locations where when you do that, San Francisco Bay is one of those Lake Elsinore down in Southern California is another. When you go out in winter, you will find blooms and toxins in some of these water bodies because they are so impaired. And so it was kind of interesting, you know, Karen was like, ooh, the satellite tool's lighting up. And I'm like, ooh, be careful. You know, I don't know if we want to, you know, how much weight to put on that. It's December. But Cameron actually did go out, I believe, and collect samples and confirmed that this was actually, you know, a bloom happening in the dead of winter. Probably because we did get some storms in, and that usually, you know, brings these big pulses of nutrients. So it's kind of an interesting thing where when you start looking in winter, you can find blooms in winter, even though it seems unlikely. And I think that's just kind of the state of our water bodies. And I think doing a eutrophication assessment, which is what we're going to be doing through some of our contracts, that's going to tell us a lot. I think that's really going to help us understand, you know, what are the conditions of our water bodies and which ones are worse and which ones are better. And so how do we kind of prioritize? Because clearly if you're having blooms in winter, that's really setting the stage to have a pretty strong bloom in the spring. So, you know, it's like, that's actually, you know, we would probably prioritize that to put some resources out towards that one. So, yeah.
One more question related to that. You mentioned San Francisco Bay and the Delta as well. How does salinity affect this? I know it's freshwater HABs that we're looking at, but is there some threshold where salinity inhibits the growth?
Yeah. So there's been a few studies. There's actually a review article where people are starting to look at what is the salinity tolerance of cyanobacteria. And a lot of that's come about because there's kind of this new understanding that when you have a lot of these reservoirs that are inland, especially with dams, you know, they're incubators for these blooms. And then you have these water releases that go all the way downstream, all the way into the ocean. And then you have cyanotoxin contamination in the ocean. And there's actually been studies in California to show, you know, that those organisms that are sometimes 200 kilometers upstream up in the Klamath, there's been a lot of work done in the Klamath, they make their way all the way down. And so, and they survive the dam release and they're intact and they're able to grow and produce more toxins. And so there's more and more work being done now to figure out, so which cyanobacteria are really salt tolerant, because when you hit the estuary, some are not, you know, some are just going to kind of lyse open and it's going to kind of kill them. But some, like the ones that produce microcystins, the ones we have in the Delta, very salt tolerant. And different strains in different areas have different tolerance, but really, you know, really salt tolerant. Some of the work that's been done in the Central Coast has shown that some of them can survive in full seawater for like a few days and continue to produce toxins. So it does, you know, when you have these things that come through the estuaries, you know, the salt will definitely influence who's there, but some of them are really tolerant. So you'll have some of them that actually survive pretty well.
I'll add that there's a better barrier going the other direction. So San Francisco Bay toxic, or that like domoic acid producing, or, you know, red tide, we don't see those in the Delta. So, yeah. Okay. I was going to add, so the satellite tool is great. If there's cloud cover, it's not going to show you what's going on there, and just reemphasize that it doesn't tell us anything about toxins, and it talks about cyanobacteria as a class. So you may have, species that are not going to produce toxin at all. So it's one tool that we can use, to really then know whether to go follow up, as Meredith said. Okay, all right, next slide. So the last thing I just wanted to emphasize on this, the Hensley and Eastman project is an example of trying to collect just more than the cyanotoxins, looking at nutrients, other water quality parameters, looking at what cyanobacteria species are there, and it intersects across our programs as well. The swamp and FHAB monitoring, of course, but we'll be able to use that data for beneficial use assessment. And it overlaps with the State Water Board's biostimulatory project because they want to be able to address lakes, but we realize in California, we really don't have much lakes data. So it's projects like this where we're able to get nutrients and cyanobacteria toxins and chlorophyll and put that all together to be able to figure out what do our nutrient thresholds really need to be. So that's a good example of that. Okay. Go ahead.
Since you did mention it, Cameron, whose name has been mentioned a few times, he was kind of one of our, I'll say, first responders to that incident that happened in Madeira. And it was pretty high drama. I mean, he used the UTV to get down with the sheriff's department and was really responding under smoky, hazy, brutal heat conditions, hiked 5 miles in the middle of the day. Got the samples from even the Camelback, I think, and then made it to FedEx with like 10 minutes to spare. So we got it out to the lab, got the samples done, and, you know, from our end, show that it wasn't harmful algal blooms that likely caused the death. You know, the subsequent investigation showed that it was, you know, heat, which is a huge danger. I think underappreciated danger sometimes, but it was a pretty heroic effort to get out there and get that job done. And kind of one of the, some of the unsung work that our board does behind the scenes to kind of resolve some of these really, really urgent water quality issues. But, you know, credit goes out to that work that was done that day. Yeah. Lots of phone calls.
Yeah. Okay. Next slide. So our board is not involved in directing people to do particular management options, but the question often arises. So wanted to touch on it briefly. And actually, through the Freshwater Harmful Algal Bloom Network, they actually have resources. There's a the website is there that gives water managers some information about what could they do to manage HABs, particularly in the short term. Short-term measures, that's when you're looking to reduce a bloom immediately. That would be things like chemical treatment or aeration, water circulation, get those algae away from the light. For long-term management, just in general, looking at things like nitrogen and phosphorus reductions, you could keep aeration going continuously, or a treatment such as a clay or alum, which will pull out and at least it'll precipitate phosphorus. As Karen mentioned, your management actions would differ depending on the water body, and considerations would be things like water body size. What other beneficial uses are there? Is it a drinking water source? Do you need to not use copper because it's a drinking water source, for example? Permit requirements, nothing is currently permitted for use against algae in the Delta, for example. Other management goals for that water body, is it endangered fish species and cost? So, okay, that's it. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so, just in summary for our eutrophication efforts, challenges, Karen mentioned some of these as well. Our routine monitoring is lacking in most water bodies, so that really does slow our recognition and understanding of the risks. In part, that's due because our funding resources are limited. And for the studies like at Clear Lake or in the Delta, that funding is short term. We've cobbled together things for the Delta in particular. And in terms of management, HABs are caused by these interacting factors, which means management's complex. And next slide. And that's all I have. Thank you for your attention.
Okay. Yeah, like, thank you, both of you. That was really informative. I hope we can get a copy of those slides.
Sure.
So we can review that at our leisure. Are there any other questions from the board? Okay, Sean, go ahead.
There you go. Just curious to know, I know that we build in partnership with the community. Do we have any sort of plan to say if there's needed information that need to be
sent out to the public. Are we doing that ourselves, or are we doing it through our partnership? Because I could see what Carmen was saying. You know, when you look through the microscope or and seeing it in person is two completely different things. And, you know, the old saying is, you know, if you don't know, it won't hurt, but sometimes it will. So, so I'm just curious.
Yeah, good question. So we do post it on our public map. So all of our partners are asked to send us the data that they've collected, and then we post it on their behalf so that the public can see it. Does that answer?
Okay, but we don't do any sort of sent mailing.
Oh, emailing out to people. Yeah. So we do let the public health agencies locally know. And we also have so we try to post signs by the water body itself. So if people are going there, they can see it as well. We don't do things like email out to like local community listservs or anything like that. But hopefully when people go to the water bodies, they will actually see signage. And it's not, we can't require people to post this signage, but wherever they are willing to, then they do.
Okay.
And we provide that signage for them for free. We can send them signs and things.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for touching on that, Sean. It actually is related to my question. Obviously, that, you know, this research is ongoing and data collection is ongoing, but the immediate obviously concern is the impacts, potential impacts to human health and animals and whatnot. And so part of that, obviously, or a large part of that, is educating the public to understand how to recognize when these instances are occurring and, you know, how to protect themselves. So I think certainly that seems like a high priority, especially with our partners as well. And to the degree that, you know, local agencies that sort of have a more direct interface with some of these water bodies, I guess maybe it's a resource allocation issue, but it does seem like we should prioritize, because it doesn't seem like these harmful algal blooms are going away anytime soon. And so what do we do to protect, you know, life?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's one of those areas where one of the heaviest components of the collaboration occurs as part of that kind of follow-up. You know, we find a HAB or somebody reports a HAB, we do the follow-up testing, figure out that, yes, you know, this is a harmful algal bloom that's happening. And then the public health notifications to agencies that manage that water body, is a huge chunk of time. I mean, it's a big deal. And then that gets into the kind of classic interface of, this agency works with CDPH and with the local health officers, because really I don't want to put it too bluntly, but there's a lot of territoriality involved with that about who makes the call, about, you know, whether this is a significant threat to human health. And statutorily and under California Constitution, there's a lot of power vested in local health officers. As we kind of found out during the pandemic, I think everybody kind of was brought to attention about how powerful these entities are and how much authority they have. So with issues like, you know, E. coli contamination comes up quite frequently. HABs are another one. A lot of authority is vested in the local health officers to kind of follow up with the signage and other things like that. So we will provide the information. We'll be as transparent as possible about putting stuff up on our website. We'll transmit to local health agencies and the reservoir managers and fellow state agencies, and then kind of leave it up to the local health departments about how they will respond to those particular issues.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Obviously, a lot of hands in this, you know.
So
important note to understand the scope of what our sort of statutory and regulatory authority is. So it really truly is just data collection and
hopefully regulating the discharges to kind of stop this stuff. But, you know, yeah, it's that, you know, that fairly blurry line of when it crosses from a water quality issue to a public health and human health issue, is the point at which it transitions from water board's authority to CDPH and local health authorities.
A lot of interagency collaboration, I suppose.
You bet. A lot of emails.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Thank you again for your work.
Yeah. No, I just like to comment that I, remember again back when that this issue started to become more of a public health issue, we talked about how to get the information out to the public. And a part of that, I know in our region, there were public service announcements around late April, May, as people start to go out and recreate, that was information put out there. So like Patrick said, it does go to the local health departments and what they do. But I would say my concern is that there's funding that becomes available to provide more direct assistance to help in addressing this problem, because it's not going away. It's increased just from my time on the board.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, when we talk about, again, not to say a couch cushion change, but we've been trying to scrape together as much money as we can to assist entities like Little Manila Rising, Restore the Delta, who are active in areas where there are a lot of HAB blooms. And, you know, to the extent that you interface with groups that could potentially qualify for grant funding to do that type of work, you know, that's, you know, it's a decent share of what Meredith does on a day-to-day basis, is kind of work with these groups, empower local citizen scientists and help people understand what the water quality concerns are within their communities that are impacting recreation. There's drinking water potential effects there too. You know, and like was mentioned during the presentations, these algal blooms can affect the taste of water, you know, even after they're gone. So a lot of concerns out there. And no easy answers, unfortunately.
I just got to say that this presentation gets worse and worse. I feel so bad. I just feel so bad about the future and water. No, I don't. But it just, you know, especially when you're talking about how they get out to the bay and that, you know, and they're still there. And I'm like, man, these things should be wearing like little masks and have like little pitchforks, and they just feel so evil. And I know that they're not. And I appreciate, you know, the complexity of what you guys are doing. But, you know, as a member of the public, you're just like, man, like, is there any safe place to stand? And it feels like that, you know, it's a complex issue.
No, I'm not going to say that's a wrong response to be totally honest. You know, you look at these bacteria and understand how they flourish and how they can overwinter or how they can move around through the water column to find their ideal spot. And kind of you get the sense that these things were around before us and they may well be around long after us. Certainly we're kind of trying to do all we can to understand this.
And that comes through. I'm not trying to say that it does.
Absolutely.
I'm just like, I see how hard this is.
Like I said, it's not, you know, looking at this like it's the blob. That's not a totally wrong response in terms of what the urgency is here and how we need to address it.
Yeah, thanks again. That was really helpful and informative, and look forward to having an update in the future. Hopefully won't be.
Yeah, I'm very eloquent up here. I'm, you know, that's me.
Yeah, thank you again. I guess I should ask Mindy if there's any interested parties who want to make a comment on this subject.
Yes, we have one commenter, Spencer Fern on Zoom, representing Restore the Delta.
Okay.
Spencer, you may unmute.
Hello. Hello, everybody.
Morning.
Good morning, guys. Everybody can hear me, right? Perfectly fine.
Yes.
Okay, cool. I just wanted to say good morning, board members. And my name is Spencer Fern, as a science coordinator with Restore the Delta. And I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to comment. And first and foremost, I just want to give thanks to the Region 5 Water Board folks like Karen Atkins, Janice Cook, Meredith Howard, Marissa Van Dyke, and the many others that have helped us set up at Restore the Delta for the upcoming HABs season. And their help has been invaluable with making sure that the data we gather is accurate. And, you know, Karen mentioned in her presentation that we were one of the groups they've been helping. And it's really nice to be able to get the training that's necessary for making sure that when we go out and test, it's not just fake or not fake data, but not necessary data. But having said that, we look forward to providing the data as we start to collect samples around the Delta in Stockton. And obviously, we'll be running the specific toxin being microcystins, which is a specific HAB, and on the waterways. And as we start to see more HABs in the area to get a better idea of what the numbers are in our region, we will also be sending those samples to the UC Santa Cruz lab to confirm if the data we collect is substantiated, and then be inputting that database or inputting that data into our own database that will soon be publicly available on our website. And I should also mention that even the data we collect will be on Excel sheets, and I'll be providing that same data with the Region 5 Water Board folks so that they can put it in their database as well. But I'm just hoping that this collaboration will help bring more visibility to the HABs issue. And we've been seeing the past decade, and hope that the issues that may arise in the communities that live in these vicinities are also notified. And one other thing, my boss is also here, and she also registered to comment. I don't know if that showed up in the agenda, but thank you for the time to comment.
Yeah, thanks for your comments. It's good to know we have partners like Restore the Delta that's helping out with the data collection. So thank you.
And so if Gene, if you could unmute Barbara Bergen-Paria.
Hi, thank you. Good morning. I am here to, well, first off, I want to say it seems fitting that we're here today on the 50th anniversary of the Clean Water Act. Board members and Director Palupa, on the one hand, we're here as part of a NGO government collaboration geared towards problem solving for the HABs challenge. And also, at the same time, we're worried. 50 years into the Clean Water Act, and we still all have so much work to do. It doesn't seem to end. I want to echo the sentiments expressed by Spencer, Dr. Meredith Howard, Dr. Janice Cook, Dr. Karen Atkins from the State Board, Marissa Van Dyke, Greg Gearhart, and Director Palupa. We thank you for the gift of your time, the support, the outreach to our organization to help us build out our HABs testing program. Everyone who's helped us has been professional, knowledgeable, good-willed, kind, and full of good humor. We also thank representatives from the Pomo Tribe at Clear Lake for sharing their knowledge to help us initially establish our program. Our partners at Little Manila Rising, they're partnering with RTD on the air quality monitoring component of all of this work, to understand how cyanotoxin is linked to PM2.5, because the communities that are really suffering in Stockton from the cyanotoxin exposure are also AB617 communities with real clean air challenges. San Francisco Baykeeper is training us in the weeks ahead on drone monitoring of HABs. And through the regional and state board, we're receiving data tracking support for air and water quality reporting from the University of North Carolina and Duke. Kind of amused that rivalry has ended up in the Delta. We'll be conducting, the simple tests as Spencer referred to. We're going to be taking samples to send to labs as needed. And we're creating a website on our space for the HABs data that will also be fed to the California Water Boards. So we will be part of a system to really help get good data out to the public as quickly as possible. While Restore the Delta and Little Manila are grant recipients from Cal EPA to work on these projects, the majority of the funding that Restore the Delta has raised to launch the HABs program and to conduct the training to put Spencer in place for drone work, for the new website updates, we've done that mostly through the Mosaic Momentum Foundation and the James Irvine Foundation. And we've been able to do this because we're conducting this work with university students, primarily from Delta and Bay Area environmental justice communities. And we've packaged the work as part of job skills and training for future employment in environmental, climate, and water industries. But I have to tell you, we're going to all have to think, I think, long-term, because funders are looking forward to launching us for a few years, but they're also asking us to come back to them to tell them how our program will be funded on a longer-term basis. I think we have to form some type of public-private partnership to make sure this work continues so that we can solve the HABS challenge and then move on to other work. You know, when I think about how it needs to be funded long enough so that we can get to the point of creating solutions. We're not interested in funding a 30-year program, but if 2 years isn't going to do it and we need five to do enough research and work towards mitigation, then we want to make sure that those funding sources are stable for everyone. Managing HABS in many ways is parallel to how COVID has to be managed. I mean, there's data gathering and tracking that will provide us all with the needed data to form, you know, the needed mitigation strategies to protect people and wildlife. We're committed in our program and grateful to the water boards because we are setting ourselves up using proper procedures and to follow best practices in the data gathering component. I'm really inspired by all these young science majors I'm working with because if it was up to me to go out and do this work, it just wouldn't happen the right way. Our goal ultimately is to work toward improved water quality through mitigation of HABS. We also today want to say that we appreciate the staff's acknowledgement of the socioeconomic impact of HABS on environmental justice communities. We see every year firsthand the impact of HABS on Delta disadvantaged communities, and it's a challenge that we very much want to resolve because it really hampers access to clean waterways. Yesterday, I did a training for high school and college advocates that work with Little Manila. And just to give you an idea, we did a really simple exercise about youth recounting a pleasurable water experience in nature. And we had 10 people in the group, and here all of these youth live in our impacted waterways community, and not one of them shared an experience of ever having recreated in a positive way in the Delta. We can't emphasize enough that despite growing our monitoring program, that we believe that HABS research needs to be fully funded within the California Water Boards. So if any of this meeting makes it to the legislature, that is our vote for funding. We believe that this work is ultimately going to require many hands for solutions to stop worsening conditions in the Delta, and frankly, all of California's waterways. You know, we saw and were given a great model of a program from the tribes at Clear Lake. Now we're building on that, and our goal is that the program that we build is going to be replicated by other groups within the Delta and within the state. We believe that knowledge and applications for problem solving is what's going to solve the HABS problem. So I just want to thank you all for the opportunity to speak. Thank you for the support, and I wish you all a great weekend.
Yeah, thank you for your input. That's kind of eye-opening to hear that nobody had a positive recreational experience and they live in the Delta communities. That's amazing. And the need for long-term funding. Hopefully, there'll be some progress on that someday. So thank you again. Are there any more questions or comments on HAB? I'd like to thank you guys again. Great presentations. And I think with that, we are ready to adjourn.
Yeah, we are adjourned. When you say so, next board meeting will be taking place on June 9th and 10th. The June 9th meeting, we will be starting bright and early, likely at 8 o'clock in the morning, to do the tour of some facilities in the foothills. And then on the 10th, we'll see if we can get the start time at 10:30. To accommodate some schedules, but that's what's next. I will also add, for those of you interested in tuning in, we will be providing an update to the State Water Board on June 7th for the CV salts issues. They are back in person. And so we will be presenting in person at the State Water Board's headquarters, 1001 I Street, and then our board meeting, the staging area for the 9th and the meeting on the 10th will be at the Rancho Cordova office out there in Rancho Cordova. So With that, I'll let you adjourn.
Thanks, Patrick. So we are adjourned. See you in June.
Quick, one more thing. There are a lot of cables everywhere and mics and screens. And I just want to say that coming back, you know, to in-person meetings and being able to have a hybrid platform, obviously a lot of work went into this. And so kudos to all the staff that really put this together, because I'll be honest, no glitches today. So
yesterday.
So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks to the entire team and for setting up the dinner last night as well. That was really nice.
Hey, you're a newcomer, but this team has been superb ever since I've been on this board. Even when we have glitches, they're seamless. And that's surprising, but that's how great of a team we have here.
Thanks. That's noted. Roberto, thanks for all your work. AGP really came through for this one. Thanks so much.
Recording stopped.